This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. I'm Richard Ferrer, and in this week's special edition of the JM Podcast, I'm joined by a panel of experts to discuss this week's startling report by the International Center for Countering Digital Hate, found that the biggest social media companies in the world, we're talking Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and TikTok, are ignoring the overwhelming majority of reported anti-Semitic posts that break their own stated guidelines. According to the report, posts which have reached millions of people were reported to these companies via their official complaint system, but then they failed to act on 84% of cases. Joining me to discuss the report's findings and look more broadly into the issue of online hate, I am delighted to be joined by Danny Stone, no stranger to the Jewish News Podcast. He's the CEO of the Anti-Semitism Policy Trust and a leading figure for many years in pushing changes to combat hate online. We're also joined by Benjamin Cohen, the CEO of Pink News and former Channel 4 technology correspondent, and also Imran Ahmed, the founding CEO of the aforementioned Center for Countering Digital Hate, who authored the report. We are hoping to also be joined by Iman Atta, the Director of Faith Matters. Hopefully she'll be with us later on, despite feeling a little unwell. I understand she's lost her voice, so hopefully we'll see her soon. So Imran, if we could start with you. The report, did it confirm your expectations, or were you shocked?
Well, look, I'm always shocked when I see the performance of social media companies when it comes to keeping people safe on their platforms, because you would have thought they'd have learned by now that after 2020, a year in which the harms that can be created on the spaces that they own, that they take their income from, and that they purport to curate, harms like the pandemic of misinformation that has accompanied the biological pandemic of COVID-19, and in the United States, where I live, has led to our inability to contain coronavirus, an inability to reach critical rates of vaccination across the country, that led on January the 6th to riots at the Capitol, that led a few weeks ago to the vicious identity-based racial abuse of England footballers and then Lewis Hamilton by some of the same accounts a few weeks later. We now see that when it comes to anti-Semitism, you know, I like numbers. I actually thought briefly about studying pure maths at university. And I know technologists love numbers. They love metrics. Well, I can put a number on how much they care about anti-Semitism. 16%. That's how much they care. And that's how much of the material that my researchers, 714 bits of not marginal stuff, outright stuff you're going to have to forgive me. I've been in this game for too long, so I say things like this. I told my team every single piece has to be something that makes you go, oh my Lord. Every single one was. So it wasn't marginal stuff, and it was for human review. And when they're human reviewers who are instructed by them using their systems and their protocols, 16%. That's how much they care about anti-Semitism.
I'm keen to get our other guests into the discussion, but it's your report, so I do want to kind of nail down some of the basics. Imagine if the police failed to investigate 84% of reported crimes. Why are we forever asking these questions of our social media platforms?
Well, it's because we don't have the tools to enforce things. There has been a sort of a certain reluctance to interfere with this burgeoning new sector, this economic opportunity. And the internet is fantastic. Social media is fantastic in many respects. In 2020, we ironically saw the best and the worst of social media. We saw its ability to connect us, to provide us with opportunities for vulnerability, for succor, for friendship, for love, in a time when we weren't physically capable of being with each other. It gave us chances to build our brands, to learn about the world around us, to connect. And at the same time, the problem with connection is, what happens if a small number of users are destroying that environment? It's very similar to the debate that we had over antisocial behavior, for example, where a tiny minority of residents can turn a block or can turn a street into a really difficult place to live. And I grew up in you know, working class neighborhood in Old Trafford. Believe me, I know that. Well, that was dealt with by being tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime. Unfortunately, the platforms aren't tough on antisocial and anti-Semitic behavior. And we can't be tough on the causes of it on their platform. It has been normalized through inaction. And it's now the place where you go to be anti-Semitic social media. And they are happy for that to be true because there are no consequences for it for the individuals. They're not deplatformed, nor are there any consequences for the companies. We can't find them. We have no tools in government or in civil society beyond shame. And it appears, as you can see with this report, that they really are beyond shame.
So no tools beyond shame, Danny. I think this is an interesting line for you to look into. The main device that the government is relying on to counter the issues that Imran and his organisation has identified is the Online Harms Bill, which is approaching, it's been such a long time now, pre-legislative scrutiny, or I believe it's in the works for later this year or early next. You'll know better than me. When the bill becomes law, platforms will have a duty of care to protect us from harmful content, and companies will face a percentage of their annual global turnover, I believe, in fines. Are you confident, as someone who's been very involved in this sphere, that the bill is capable of holding chief executives of these firms to account?
It depends how closely they listen to Imran and Benjamin and myself, I suppose, in terms of how well this bill will be crafted. I think they need to listen very carefully to the experiences that we've had. Let's take an example from this week. TalkSport Radio have a caller call in, makes an anti-Semitic comment. Right. If it were broadcast on the radio, and it was not, it would have been a breach of Ofcom's guidelines. Absolutely, unequivocally. It was broadcast on YouTube. There's nothing doing about what happened on YouTube. Nothing. Right. YouTube can't really explain why it wasn't taken down, why it wasn't caught at the time. And there's a problem there with the system, which is live streaming. Right. The bill, if it works well, will deal with systems. It will catch these systems at the earliest stage, right? It will force the companies to look at their systems and say, well, there may be problems downstream. How do we address them upstream? Now, at the moment, the bill is slightly perhaps overcomplex. You know, you said it will make these companies deal with legal but harmful content. Well, to an extent, the bill as it's drafted asks the companies to have terms and conditions that quote unquote deal with this stuff. Now, there are plenty of social media companies out there with terms and conditions. I don't think they deal with this stuff at all. Some of them do it better than others. But irrespective of that, as Imran and CCDH's report has proven, it's all about enforcement anyway, right? It doesn't matter if you've got terms and conditions if you don't enforce them properly. The other point about the bill is, you know, at the moment, yes, it proposes fines on companies. For the largest of these companies, that will be written off as the cost of doing business. You need to hold the senior executives to account, like we do in health and safety executives, like we do elsewhere in financial services. The senior executives need to be held to account. And the way the government's dealt with that, they're reserving the power to do that. And they only bring it in a very limited way in respect of those senior executives providing certain amounts of information, not holding them accountable for a duty of care. So in my view, if the bill's to be really effective, the senior managers need to know that there's the potential for them to be personally liable, held accountable for what's happening on their platforms and breaching those duties of care. And without that, I'm not sure the bill will be strong enough, but we'll be making that case as it goes through the pre-legislative scrutiny and all the rest.
Yeah, that's the nub of it, isn't it? If I, as the editor of the Jewish News, publish race hate or libel, I face the consequences. I operate under that understanding. I police myself accordingly. There is no such publisher's liability in place currently. So is that's the cure, Danny, as far as you're aware? I know we've had green papers and white papers and purple papers with pink spots on. And finally, we've got this bill that's coming through. As I said, you'll know better than me. Does it include publisher's liability at this stage?
So the social media companies deem themselves to be publishers or not, depending on how useful it is to them at the time. I think there is an argument, certainly, that they are publishers. I'm not sure that the existing frameworks could necessarily work in kind of determining them as publishers, just because the amount of content that's on the system is too large for that. But yes, do I think they should be held liable in extremis for failures to apply a duty of care? Yes, I do. And in that respect, they could be considered publishers. They do, at the moment, under existing kind of European rules, they do have liability in certain circumstances. So if they're asked to say take something illegal down and they fail to do it in a certain time frame, expeditiously, I think is the word, then they do become liable. But it's a very limited liability. I would like to see that liability extended.
Right. Benjamin, thanks for your patience. So look, you don't need to be a high profile Jewish commentator like yourself to see that the online status quo, it's untenable, it's unbearable, it's an unregulated mess. But I also imagine that you don't particularly want to see your free speech curtailed just because of the intimidating behaviour of a bunch of fools, and thankfully they are still a minority. So where do you, as a publisher and as a commentator, where do you draw the line between those civil liberties and free speech and the right not to be abused online?
It's really complicated. I was just thinking about the different scenarios when Danny was speaking, because I have to think about it for myself as the CEO of a business which is publishing and people write comments on our content. Primarily, we don't have that many comments on our website or our apps or within our own controlled system. The reason we don't have very many is we do have a paywall for commenting, and that's because of the huge volume of homophobic, transphobic, racist, including anti-Semitic abuse that's on there. On our Facebook, it's hard. I was just literally on a call yesterday talking about how we can better moderate Facebook, because Facebook doesn't give good enough controls to publishers. So on my own platform, my own business, there are users spreading anti-Semitic hatred directed at me. And it's actually really hard for us to be able to control it, because although it's responding to content published by Pink News, it's Facebook users, and Facebook doesn't give good enough controls to publishers to be able to moderate the content that appears on their own Facebook pages. And you know, users can report it, I can report it, and Facebook is very inconsistent with the way that it deals with whether it's homophobia, transphobia, racism, including anti-Semitism that exists there. You know, we see it. It was only, I think it was about a week ago, wasn't it, that maybe 2 weeks ago, Mark Zuckerberg, the founder and CEO of Facebook, posted a picture of his dog wearing a kippah, and there was huge levels of anti-Semitism directed at him. And if Facebook can't even control the comments on its own founder and CEO's Facebook page, what the hell is it able to do for us or anyone else who's experiencing anti-Semitism? Because, you know, sometimes you can feel when you're getting it on Facebook and no one's responding, well, this is Facebook not doing a very good job. It's something kind of personal to me, but it's not personal to me. It's to all Jews, and it's to all people of ethnic minorities and all people of diverse sexual orientations or gender identities. So it's across the board, and it's unable to deal with it. I don't know the things like the online harms bill in terms of what is proposed, as well as Danny, but I am concerned about its realistic implementation of anything, because anything we're doing from a UK perspective can't necessarily deal with this. It may make the situation slightly better for those people who are viewing content in the UK, but this does require global legislation and cooperation, in my view. When you think about the abuse that Imran was talking about that was directed at the England players, just like it happens with me, most of that's not coming from the UK. It's coming from people in America. And they're then using free speech amendments in the US Constitution and others to defend some of the abuse that they're sending, which is why it's quite hard. So I was actually having a chat with the commissioner of the Met a couple of weeks ago, and we were discussing the frank inability of the police to deal with it. And the primary inability was because the abuse was coming from outside of the UK. And it's very hard for the Met to start investigating some random person in Texas or something who's sending abuse to people. That's the issue. And I think that also needs to be considered, and I think it's an important point, and it's something that I'm experiencing quite a bit at the moment, is obviously when things go from social media to the way that people think and the way that people behave in the real world. So if I think about some of the anti-Semitic abuse that I've been receiving recently in the real world and in all sorts of, well, certainly off social media, it is very much informed by the anti-Semitic tropes that are being shared on social media. So we have to remember at all times, this isn't just an issue inside Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. It's an issue that then bleeds into the way that all of us experience our, you know, our daily lives, because it's informing, unfortunately, the way that quite a lot of people think, whether that's relating to issues to do with Israel and holding Jews to account for decisions of Israel, or just spreading kind of Corbynite style anti-Semitic tropes that people were spreading during that era in the Labour Party on social media about people. And I unfortunately bear a particular brunt of it because I fulfill certain stereotypes of being a, you know, relatively wealthy Jew that's running a digital media company, the largest in the space for LGBT things. So I fulfill all the stereotypes of a Jew that they're talking about. And then unfortunately, some of the rubbish that they read about on social media, they then, you know, impart to me in their conspiracy theory. So I think it's important to understand that this isn't just about Twitter and Facebook. This is about real life too.
So thank you, Benjamin. In terms of real life, Danny, then, just to move that point that Benjamin was making on. So there's an attitude that the attacks aren't on people, they're not on property. It's not real anti-Semitism. These are social media posts. So is that what enables this space to become normalized for racists and conspiracy theories and people just to churn out hateful rhetoric without fear of consequence, that this feeling that it's belittling the level of importance?
And I was asked in an interview this week about, you know, well, isn't it the kinetic stuff that really matters, the stuff outside of social media? And my response was, you cannot divorce the two, right? If you look at the coronavirus conspiracies that were spreading at the beginning of the pandemic, and then you look at some of the real world, as what Benjamin was just saying, right? The real world impact of that, people holding up signs at rallies, and what that leads to, a Jewish guy being refused service in a car shop in New York because supposedly he's one of the super spreaders or responsible for the pandemic. You know, it has real life impact. We've known that for years. We know that in terms of incels, involuntary celibates, the kind of the manosphere. We've seen these attacks on women, misogynist attacks coming, I think, 6 mass killings since 2014. We've seen the terrorism. You've seen terrorist manifestos. We know that this stuff has real world impact. You know, the Finsbury Park mosque attack, the guy was radicalized online in a number of weeks and then went and attacked a mosque. You know, so there is, I think it's illogical to suggest that there isn't a complete mix. And I know that Imran wants to come in. Just one thing on free speech. My view is, firstly, that I don't think that Benjamin or Pink News or anywhere else would be held responsible for Facebook comments, that the responsibility will be where there's liability for breaching that duty of care, which will probably be over a series of different incidents or events and what have you. I don't think it will be on particular content necessarily, but perhaps on a failure to address that content. And I think it's a misnomer to suggest that we have free speech on social media, because the way in which the platforms amend what you see, divert what you see, direct what you see, it's not the same as going into a town square. It's a very different kind of space.
Imran, what did you want to say?
I think one of the things that we've got to remember when we're looking to regulating these companies effectively is that, using the analogies of publishing businesses or platforms or something else, that they're actually insufficient metaphors to understand what these companies are. These are fundamentally advertising businesses. 98% of the revenues of Facebook comes from advertising. And it generates that advertising, but through other people's content. So first of all, we, the users, we're not users, we're the product. We, the product, the cattle, we produce content. That is then fed into different algorithms. And those algorithms, those black boxes that we have no insight into, because of course they won't even let regulators or legislators see what they are, they then look at the attention that's generated by each bit of content. That attention is then the key to it, because what we're interested in is then sold to advertisers. And that attention is then used to reorder content, to make the content ordering more addictive. So they put the most addictive content at the top. What that has done is, first of all, by reordering the content, it's put the most sticky and addictive content at top. And that's the most controversial, the most dangerous content, the stuff that makes our society seem more brittle, more polarized, more vociferous. And at the same time, what it does is it encourages conspiracism, for example, because conspiracy theories are really sticky content, because once you've had one, you want more, you rabbit hole. There's a really strong psychological reason for it, which is that anxiety drives conspiracism, but it never sates it. So you're constantly looking for more conspiracy theories. And the problem that we've got is that these advertising driven businesses that treat us as cattle and the advertisers as kings. And if you've ever tried to advertise on one of these platforms, you'll know the richness of the data available to you. That has created a new type of entity that will need a new type of regulation.
You have to understand that these companies do not, at the moment, they realize that no one's figured them out. And that's why regulators and legislators around the world are trying different things. So, you know, in the UK, we're trying to use a health and safety approach to it. In Germany and New Zealand, they've outlawed certain types of speech. In the US, they're trying to make it more easy to sue the company to remove what's called their liability shield. But fundamentally, these companies are telling us all the time what they are. So one of their top guys, Andrew Bosworth, once wrote a memo internally. He said, "We connect people, period. That's why all the work we do in growth is justified. All the questionable contact importing practices, all the subtle language we use." Now that can be bad if they make it negative. Maybe it costs someone a life by exposing themselves to bullies. Maybe someone dies in a terrorist attack coordinating our tools, and still we connect people. The ugly truth is that we believe in connecting people so deeply that anything that allows us to connect more people more often is de facto good. And he wrote that as one of their most senior guys on their internal portal just a couple of years ago. We are up against zealots. We're not up against normal companies that operate to the rules and morality that we're used to. Six people who have networked 3.5 billion people on Earth and control hundreds of billions of dollars of wealth. And the challenge is, like the challenge with big oil and climate change, like the challenge with big tobacco and the mass addiction of vast numbers of people with something that will kill them, we're going to have to work out how to regulate these behemoths. But here's the thing. From big oil and from big tobacco, we know it's possible. And so what we're going to need is the political understanding, first of all, which is part of all of our jobs, of what the real problem is, and then the will to act. And that's what we're trying to drive forward.
I met Zuckerberg quite a few times and interviewed him for Channel 4 News once. And this is the same message that he was saying. But that was way back. So it was like 2008. It was all about connecting people. And I would definitely say it is a zealous approach to what they're doing. One thing I would say, though, I think it's worth noting, in the report, it wasn't really, I don't think they mentioned Snapchat. So there obviously are multiple different platforms. We work very closely with Snap, and I've met Evan Spiegel, the founder of that. They take a different approach. You don't tend to find anti-Semitism on their platform because it's a much more privacy-aware platform, and also all publishing on there is heavily regulated. It doesn't have an open publishing platform in the same way that Facebook or Twitter do. So they only work with a very limited number of kind of publishing partners. We're one, we have 9 or 10 channels on there. And there's really strict content guidelines. So this sort of hate speech just wouldn't be allowed. And if someone did post it, it would be removed quite quickly. So I think it's worth noting that obviously they're nowhere near the size of Facebook, but it is possible for social media to be not quite as nasty a place as it often does appear on Facebook and Twitter. Snapchat shows that it can do. And I think that there are other platforms which are nicer places to be with greater controls. I think it's worth noting. So when Facebook and others will say, well, you know, this is the nature of like social media and things, it's because of the parameters that they've decided to set themselves. It's the way that it is, and it encourages debate, it encourages vitriol. So if I think about my own tweets on Twitter, if I actually post something anti-Semitism, generally gets quite a reasonable reach. If I post something that is attacking, for example, transphobic people, that gets viewed by a lot of people. Why does it get viewed by a lot of people? Because a load of transphobic people will come into the comments and start attacking me or trans people. Often I find that they will then also say an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory around Jewish billionaires funding the trans rights movement, which is totally not the case. But Twitter is amplifying that argument. Ditto Facebook. You see the same thing. And that's because it does draw in people's attention, and it's all about the attention economy. And I think we have to bear in mind, and the fact that different social media platforms do take a different approach to that, is when we think about regulation, think about whether other platforms should be more like Snapchat in the way that they regulate their content and control the content that's on their platform, and the responsibility that they take to try and create a nice experience for its users, in their case, very young users.
I regret our time is over. That's where we're going to have to leave this edition of the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group. Through its partners, GPG works to support the growth of Jewish community life in the UK and worldwide. Find out more at gpg.org. I'd like to thank my guests, Imran Ahmed, Benjamin Cohen, and Danny Stone. Our producer, Adam Bradley, for his work on post-production, and of course you for listening. And please do subscribe to the show in your podcast application. That way you'll get to hear about previous episodes or be informed when new ones become available. And if you'd like to comment, we'd always love to hear from you. editorial@jewishnews.co.uk, editorial@jewishnews.co.uk. So from me, Richard Ferrer, do join us next time here on the Jewish News Podcast. Goodbye.